This talk is about Polygot, JVM, Scala, Clojure, and Kotlin. It's 11:30, and we are about 10, 12 people.
Okay, so there are three different convenience for this talk, but I would like to begin by repeating what I said at the beginning. We would like to collect information on people that have tried Polygot JVM and failed, and also succeed, so that we help these people succeed if they really want to, and also keep spreading the word on why it would be a good idea to mix and match a different language other than Java when you're working on the projects.
For some organizations, think we need someone who takes notes so that we don't thank you. So it's about mixing languages in one project, right?
Mixing languages in one project, yes, to get the goals done. But there's nothing. There is a link to an online form that I will post on the wiki later in the day or maybe tomorrow. This is a form that has a few questions on the things that we are collecting for this talk that we will present at the Java Conference later in the year. So if you would like to help us,
you think like
that would be very awesome. Thank you very much.
Okay. You mostly wanted to talk a bit about Kotlin, right? And why Kotlin came to be that? That's an interesting thing.
Yeah, so I think it's not really. So I can do my traditional presentation on Kotlin, but I don't think it's like the right forum for that, so I'd rather take questions on Kotlin and.
Because I think it's really interesting why you started with Kotlin in the first place, right?
Maybe it would be interesting to have a comparison, because I think Scala was not there before, and Clojure I think also, and so what made you start with Kotlin would be an interesting question to hear about.
What I would also be interested in is how you manage multiple languages on the Java forum for the customer. So when the customer wants to write its own script in one of these languages, how you take care of the security or modularize it so you don't allow the customer to just do everything with your server.
So if you use them for extensibility, like no allow JavaScript or JRuby or something like that, or Ruby is secure as policy application. So in general, I also think one of the big topics is if you do polyglot, how do you do it, you know, like for build systems, how do you do a language integration across the languages if you call stuff from one language to the other and so on. So what are kind of typical points where this kind of polyglot happens to kind of coincide or kind of meet each other, right? Because just staying in Scala or just staying in Groovy is not so much a challenge, right? Because language in itself, it's kind of closed. But every time you kind of have a border between the languages, be it in build, be it in interoperability, and so that's, I think, one of the bigger challenges there.
So, also, what makes you choose these two languages in the first place? Maybe that's a good point to start. I mean, often it's just the best programmers who want to play with it, of course.
Yeah. Of course, I can begin with my own personal experience why I branch it out of the JVM and discover a different JVM language. In the early days, when we only had applets, well, Java was kind of fun, but the box that came with it was very small. So I branched it out to other languages such as PHP, JavaScript, also a little bit of Perl. There's no excuse there. But so they're very dynamic, they're very open, you can go crazy, you can do silly stuff and really stupid stuff. And then you saw again back the power of the JVM. It was a time when we had these huge application servers and the server-side based technology. Everybody was going back to the JVM, so I did sort of the same thing. And I kept longing from some bit of dynamicity in the language because the box was a little bit bigger than before, but it was still smaller compared to the other those languages that was using in the past. So that's how I encountered Groovy, which is very similar to Java in a sense, but gives you a dynamic mixing, a dynamic feature. And after that, I also play with other languages. I play with Clojure, I play with Scala, I play a little bit with Kotlin, even I did a little bit with Phantom. In the end, I come back to Ruby because for some reason I believe it's either the community, it is the feeling of the language that makes me feel right at home. It's easy to mix and match Ruby and Java without any problems.
Of course, they're quite similar after all.
The syntax is very similar, yes. And as a matter of fact, it's almost the case, in almost every case, you can rename a .java file to .ruby, compile it with a Ruby compiler, and it will work. It's just that close. It's not 100% equal, but it's very, very close, as opposed to the other languages, where that certainly cannot happen.
Because I started using Ruby, Excel, and WordPress, and that's also a problem with Ruby, in my opinion, because after a while, I mean, just to give you a small introduction, after coming here 2 years ago, we started using Ruby in our project, and our percentage of Ruby code really got increased, and that was in Vodafone, but it was very enterprise. So, but at the end, everybody, it took just a while. The problem is that after a while, I realized that, I was studying in Ruby, but most of the people just using Ruby as it was Java. So they were writing not idiomatic Ruby code, but just Javish Ruby code. They don't know that in Ruby you don't have to instantiate a collection, you don't have to do new, most of the case at least. And you don't know that you can, they know, but still they don't use, you can skip the dot, skip most of the items, and make much more clean DSL kind of stuff. It's a bless, but it's also
actually that's a general thing that I wanted to put in as well, is why do we do polyglot in the first place?
Yeah.
There has to be some advantage over Java to do go with other languages, because there's always also a cost, right? You have to learn a second language, you have to educate people, you have to integrate them and so on. So there must be a kind of huge enough benefit over Java to add other languages to your application, right?
Yeah. I think it's not too hard to have a free benefit over Java.
plus one.
Yeah. but it's really interesting, right? So you have to have it, and it would be interesting to see for the different languages what the benefit actually is.
For us, the cost of adding an extra GDM language is not too hard, so we already have to build the tooling to support user projects to support impact and cross compilation and all these qualities and stuff. But for us, and once we have this support, it's not difficult at all to drop in some Ruby code. So as we add this question, we don't have any Kotlin code in the IntelliJ database now, but we do have a bunch of Ruby code primarily for the test and for the build system. And we simply didn't see any like big code when we started using it. People wanted to write in their test and Ruby simply started doing that, and they didn't cause any pain to anyone else, and they just go happy with that.
Also, my experience, because when I first saw Ruby, I detested it because of its closeness to Java, because it's not pure, it just seemed like a bunch of hacks. But the point when I started to use it is when I saw Spock, this testing framework. It was really very nice, and the dynamicity there allowed one, for example, to call protected private methods, which is sometimes quite nice for tests without having to do this hex. And a killer feature is, of course, the collection stuff if you want to test for results from collections. And so the test code just reads much nicer. So that was the line we drew in that project. It was just for testing there. But
if you look beyond Ruby, Ruby is really close to Java, right? So there's not much learning cost. If you look at Scala, for instance, of course you can write Java-ish Scala code, but then you won't be happy, right?
Yeah.
Or if you look at Clojure, which is even further apart from Java.
There's no Java-ish
Clojure. You never know what people can come up with. So there's a much higher cost on the learning side, but then there has to be a much bigger benefit that you have to get from the language, actually. Or, even Kotlin is more different from Java than Groovy is from Java, right?
Yeah, for us, we didn't have a goal at all of like having the syntax exactly like Java, so we were okay with going a bit away from that in order to make the language like more expressive and so easy to read that.
So what's the advantage over Java of Kotlin that you would kind of state as the big thing that makes it?
Well, simply being more expressive and more readable. Actually, the funny like many people say that it's okay, so you start with Kotlin when Java 8 did not exist, and now Java 8 is about to be released, and then no one goes with Kotlin because Java 8 has closures, and that's the big thing. But interestingly, in our own experience, like the biggest distribution feature of Kotlin compared to all the other languages is the extension functions. It's the stuff that you have in the C-sharp, obviously, but you don't really have anything directly like that on the JVM world. So Scala has pieces which allow you to achieve like the same results in slightly more convoluted way, I would say.
Your representation models, but it's not exactly the same.
I don't know. If you look at the flavor of the result that you get when you start really writing Kotlin code, then that's what makes the big difference.
So it's interesting because expressiveness is something that's kind of not on the machine side, but on the human side, right? So it's more, so does it mean that Polyglot is more about the developers than the machine, right? Because, for instance, Groovy code, plain Groovy code is slower than pure Java code, right?
Things
like that. So what is the advantage? Is it over...
Before we go into that, Leslie has something to say. Yeah.
Last year there was a similar extension. One of the points was that it's not that it's more expressive in that you get quicker at some stuff that is not adding value to your problem. And also, if you start using it on testing, it's a playground, it's something that is not actually something seen from the customer, and at the same time, it's not a code that you need to worry about too much about the performance. So it's a perfect scenario. Then, okay, you don't have a training plan at the office, or you do, but you just burn all the budget of the year. But still, you have some play on there. It's another argument on that front. Still, there's more consent to consider.
So the expressiveness in terms of boilerplate code, not boilerplate code, and focus on the core business code.
One thing I throw out is, I mean, I think there's huge value in the JVM and the fact that it enables you to have languages that compile down to jar files and let you incrementally adopt them as these. You know, I mean, I'm used to working on multi-module Maven projects, right? Or the same is true with Gradle or whatever. And you actually can start, you can have a large Java project, and then one day decide, well, I'm going to start experimenting with language X. And provided language X compiles down into, you know, a jar file that is otherwise in this, behaves exactly the same as if it had been written in Java, then that kind of completely really minimizes the barrier to adopting that language. And it's not, interestingly, though, not all JVM languages have that characteristic, right? Like other, I think there are JVM languages where they can cool Java, but they can't easily be cooled from Java, which to me makes them kind of less interesting, right? And particularly because, you know, many Java developers aren't working on greenfield projects, they're actually working on old projects, but you can't just throw them away.
Yeah, that's actually one of our main goals with Kotlin, so that you can take a Java project, like a 5-minute line of code, take a single class, convert it from Java to Kotlin, and not attack any other code in the project and have it still working, just as a
So transparent.
Yes, and actually that's one of our biggest philosophical differences with C-Long, because like the languages are developed at the same time, and we had some discussions about maybe we should collaborate and join our forces. But that's really where the distinction lies. So the C-Long guys say that once you have a read a nice language, you can write your really nice frameworks all over again. You don't want to be using any of the old frameworks because they are old style and they are not nice enough.
It's permanent bridges.
Well, interestingly, the Scala guys actually argue the same thing.
Yeah, it's true.
Well, no, there's two parts to that. Like, Scala is very interoperable with Java, right? And, like, I've written Scala apps using Spring Framework and Hibernate, and it all just works fine. But there's a chunk of the Scala community who are intent on reinventing the wheel, which I think is a kind of, I mean, Rod Johnson, I think, alluded to this at Scala Days, and I think it's a major mistake that they're making.
But our Scala codes can be called from Java.
Exactly. Much more difficult.
If you use the higher level, more complex features of Scala, it would be.
If you write idiomatic Scala code, then
called from Java.
Obviously.
And also, if you want to use Scala collections from Java, you have to convert them or wrap them.
That's actually a very important point because. Collections is actually a big thing with interoperability because you can have, like, of course you can convert one kind of collections to another, but because collections are used all over the place in every program, you start to lose a lot of performance, like, if they convert one kind of collection to another. And the approach we are taking with Kotlin is a very pragmatic one. It's not pure from any point of view, but a very pragmatic one. So we, on the compiler side, we come up with artificial interfaces like binomial collections, immutable and mutable collections. And they compile down to the same regular Java utility list. But when you're on the Kotlin side, you are expressing the mutability, you're expressing the variance, and you're dealing with a clean, you're writing clean, like, really nice idiomatic code, but you do not have to pay anything on the runtime side.
So it's a bit like
sort of collections are our Java util collections.
So we have our own interfaces that
on
like
top of that.
The virtual interfaces that do not exist in the Java bytecode, but they exist in the runtime.
You somehow enrich the JDK with something that is visible to Kotlin that makes it work much better, given the philosophy.
So it's a bit like erasure in general.
To some degree. Yes, this is specific to the collection. So if you have another similar framework that has similar requirements, then you will not have this
Because something that we've also seen, for instance, with Scala collections, that they have really different performance characteristics from Java collections. And they might be purer in many ways, but they have also, you know, either linear or logarithmic complexity for insert operations and stuff like that. So you have to really watch out, especially if you are in PCs where you have performance critical parts, then these Scala collections can sometimes even hurt you. Actually, that's something probably with each of the other languages. You have to invest enough time to really learn the ins and outs of the language and not just to the kind of superficial thing, because the superficial thing leads you also to wrong assumptions about the language. Because it feels so object-oriented and it feels like Java, it will kind of behave like Java. And this kind of assumption can be really wrong, and then it hits you in the critical cases, and that's...
If you're shooting for performance, you have to go to the biggest level of what thing you're actually using. So the first thing that people find out when doing the Scala is, it's not that I really want to become Scala, but for comprehension, they're reading stuff. You see, for Microsoft, that's really readable. I can understand that. But if you're shooting for performance, that is the worst thing that you can use. Then you change to something else, which will be very performant, but the first thing, when you see it, you don't understand it. So you have to take just a little moment and say, now I get it. And that's why it's working this way. So that's perfect. So it's a balance. So why branch out to a different JVM language? In my case, first is readability, because we know Java is very verbose. The second, which might not be true once JDK comes out, is closures or functions, right? And the third one is, in my case, was runtime metaprogramming, how I can change a program while it's still running. Some languages allow to do these things, some others don't. In my case, I really love the capability to just do anything I want to do with the code that I wrote, or even the code that somebody else wrote.
Do you kind of use runtime metaprogramming a lot in production code, or is it rather on the experimental test side of things?
I don't have any problems doing it with production code, but
since Ruby 1.6, we have the option to put metaprogramming down to the compiler level, so that's called lazy transformations. If possible, if I have access to the source code, then I would prefer to do compile time metaprogramming, because that will make these things visible to other JVM languages. So you can call these new additions from Java. So again, the interoperability between these two languages is very, very nice. And performance-wise, it's a little bit faster if you do it at the compile time.
How about visibility of these metaprogramming things to, you know, if I just read some code, how do I infer where this new function comes from? You know, because if it's at compile time or metaprogramming stuff, many people have a problem kind of inferring or keeping in their mental model all the kind of additional stuff that happens somehow.
I think that most of the times happens organically, but I can say that it's almost as similar as in Scala, where you don't know if that's implicit is going to be taken into account or not. Mm-hmm. Your best option so far is the proper documentation.
So just to know where we are, what do we use? Do we use Scala? Do we use Ruby? Sometimes here, Ruby? Scala?
Closure?
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 Closure. Okay. Okay.
Some other languages, JRuby maybe?
JRuby,
yeah,
in the past. Somebody has finished with NASCAL?
Yeah, it's cool.
So
we have Rhino in Java 6, right, and Java 7. Rhino is JVM implementation of JavaScript, which is ultra slow. It's like factor 1,000 to 10, depending on the kind of calls that you do, slower than V8. So there is actually a V8 Java script engine binding for the JVM, so you can run JavaScript code with V8 in the Java 6 and Java 7 VMs, which is really cool. But then I tested NASWAN against the V8 binding, and NASWAN, which is the Java 8 pre-implementation of JavaScript, so Attila works on that, and they did a lot of using method handlers and all the new stuff, invoke dynamic stuff, and also a lot of stuff that people in the V8 and with Dart do kind of static compilation of JavaScript and stuff like that, recompilation and so on. And actually it turned out that the NASWAN code was 2 to 3 times faster than the V8 binding, which was really impressive.
Our article is building a version of Node on top of NASWAN called JNuke, which is full Java, full JavaScript, and it's pretty fast.
So one thing I would kind of point, I don't know if it's a question or a comment, but it's like, so when we talk about polyglot apps, what are we talking about? Are we talking about monolithic applications that are written in a bunch of different languages? So one JVM supporting all these languages, or are we talking about, one term is a microservice architecture, where our system is comprised of a set of services, many of which are quite small, and then those services are written in a variety of different languages.
How do the microservices communicate?
The services are communicating. I mean, it could be REST or it could be some kind of messaging.
It actually wouldn't matter if some of that wouldn't actually be JVM based, right? So
yeah, because I mean, it's sort of interesting because, I mean, one architecture, the architecture that's been interesting me more and more is like moving away from monolithic apps, which is practically every app I've built over the past 12 years has just been one big monolithic app, to actually more of a microservice architecture.
Yep.
And in which case, we're not just using the JVM, right? So if we want to use Node, it's actually the Node runtime or the Python runtime, rather than just everything being on the JVM.
Back to the Unix paradigm, we have a lot of little processes.
That's
simple protocols. Yeah.
That's an excellent analogy. And the reason that got me into Node.js is actually using that as the front end, like the API gateway, single entry point into all of those services.
Yeah. It's interesting. I think it depends also if you do greenfield development or if you have brownfield. So you have like a 10-year-old system or large systems that existed for 10, 15 years in Java, and you kind of want to gradually migrate parts of that into something that's, you know, easier to maintain and so on. I think microservices are really cool for new stuff, but I'm not sure how well they fit into, you know.
We have done that. It's also nice for old stuff. It's made very nice. It gives the people,
first, we had an old JBoss application, and we split parts out of it to run under their own Jetty and Westlet services. All the new services are written almost exclusively in Scala, but we use Java libraries if available. And we have many of these new services running now, and we still have some code in the old JBoss application, and everything communicates by REST, RabbitMQ, and databases. And it's working fine, and it's a way forward to migrate logic off the old application. Mm-hmm. And it's working with the code. You can test the services independently, and I think it's a good way forward to manage the complexity.
Can I ask you a question? Because at least in London there's a lot of discussion about this kind of architecture. Some companies that I talk to, they have a kind of a central architect that decides the world.
Yes.
Other instead say that each team can do basically they want. So
well, we have one medium-sized team, about 10 people, and we have no dedicated architect. And we do some kind of scrum and decide together.
There is no architecture.
There is no central architect.
I was in a situation like that, and in 3 years we scaled up to 60 people, and having one person, it's a complete failure. The thing to me when talking about Polyglot is not that each box can be implemented in a different language, but a single box is merging different stuff. So when I compile a very small code base, it's still merging several compilers and several Scala or Java.
I think the focus of this session is really Polyglot within an app, and I think we have other sessions that talk about more microservice architectures and so on. So we probably should stick with the Polyglot within an app for here, and because otherwise we will kind of dilute the topic. But we can. I also think it's within an app, and for us it was that we had in Neo4j. For the query language, we needed something that has, you know, good parser libraries and kind of a functional approach to implement the execution engine. So we went to Scala to do that, right? So Neo4j is mainly Java, but everything around the query language is all Scala, from the parser to the execution engine.
Did you use the Combinator parser library?
We started with the parser Combinator, but as it's too slow, we switched to PG. Mm-hmm. Now in Neo4j we have lots of places where they have to interoperate, right? And that's also one challenge. The other challenge that we have is really building system, because Scala compiler is so slow. And also kind of integrating, you know, Maven crap, and also IntelliJ getting it to run with the multi-language projects, and it blows up sometimes, and, you know, stuff like that. And so there are lots of challenges in Polyglot. And one of the big challenges is also to get the developers up to speed in Scala to write idiomatic Scala code, because they just would write Java code in Scala. And that's kind of one of the big challenges that we also have, right? And, you know, and also kind of the love-hate thing, because, you know, we have lots of divas in our team. So they have all strong opinions, and some of them hate Scala, and some of them love Scala, and so it's also, you know, people problem.
Yeah, well, going back to the question of what is stuff in Scala, and actually the compiler performance of Scala was actually one of the big reasons why we didn't run the engine, because, well, we have a 5 minute line of code, and it takes, for the fast laptop, it takes something like 12 minutes to do a full rebuild, and if you use Scala, it would take probably 1 hour and a half minutes, something like that. Yeah. We simply cannot afford this kind of
turnaround.
Yeah, one of the major philosophical differences between Kotlin and Scala is that Scala is very theoretic and Kotlin is much more pragmatic. So Scala tried to come up with like a single overarching concept for consulting and to come up with
for computation.
yes, to come up with as many different use cases for this as possible. And Kotlin does not try to do that. They're going more like PHP way, I would say, even that. So that we come up with specific problems that we want to solve, and we design a solution for this specific problem without trying to build an overarching theory for that. For example, I don't know, nullability is a very good example. So Scala has on it, Scala has a baby on it. And this is based on a theoretical concept that solves the nullability problem. And there's a lot of things you can do with maybe one that you cannot do with null fact. But it's not as simple to understand for novice people.
But I would throw out there the Tony Ford who came up with the concept of null points and said it was a $1 trillion mistake.
I know. and in Kotlin we have this specific solution for this specific problem. We have a tool that analyzes Java by including first the nullability contacts of functions that were written in Java and then compiled to Java by code. And so that the Kotlin compiler uses information to allow you to avoid writing extra null checks and nullability annotations in Kotlin code. And this is a pragmatic solution. It's not based on a theoretical concept, but it's very nice.
You mentioned now that the Scala compiler as well, which is one of which problems did you have to manage when in a polyglot code base you found that there were a compiler like the first and then the Scala compiler and then the Java one? And my first attempt when working with Java and Scala was based on Maven for the build, and I happened to find a plugin for building, but it had some issues when there was dependencies from Java into Scala, into Java, into Scala. It then evolved and moved into SVT. I had no experience on Kotlin or Ruby and so on. What's the state of the art there? Is it all quite mature? Is it something that should be, that is adding an extra delay on compilation? What's the best approach there? What should someone try to work?
I would say that it depends from project to project. So the latest, probably the most well-known JVM languages out there, Kotlin, Ceylon, Scala, Ruby, probably closer to us to some extent, because I haven't done Ruby so much lately. They have this thing called the joint compiler. So you can compile their sources plus Java sources in the same compiler
station. But it's always just two languages, Java
and
Scala.
Yeah, there's only two languages. Yeah. Like to mix three problem. But there's also a problem depending on how these the relationship between the two sources. So you have an interface in Java that's implemented in language X, and this class is also using another class in Java, which, by the way, relates to something else in the language X. Some of these languages do this thing nicely, some others are still a bit wonky. The problem is that under the covers, you are running two different compilers. For most of them, you have to run Java C at some point, and you have to run the compiler X at some other point. So compiler X has to, and what we did in Ruby, we had stops. We compiled stops in the first step, then compile everything that is Java, and then recompile everything with the Ruby compiler. The other languages use a C matrix or something else.
Yeah, provision is handled in the build tools.
So it's
Provision is probably the weakest of the one which is in this regard.
The problem that you have to do perhaps is try to, if possible, break the dependencies between one type of source and the other so that you can assert for most of the time that if you compile one first, then the other will work. You can also use Java as an IDL. So all of these languages can operate with Java, no problem. So use it to define all the interfaces and then compile one thing and then compile the other, and this should work.
That actually story is not an interesting direction, because we in the Kotlin, so we have already implemented obviously a parser for Java, and if they incorporate this into the Kotlin compiler, so the Kotlin compiler can build a complete model of your Java and Kotlin code base, regardless of whether you have compiled the Java classes to bytecode or to just have the source code. So you just catalog this and then compile the Kotlin code to the bytecode, and then run the Java compiler which has access to all the classes which may have compiled from the Kotlin code, and it just needs to compile the Java part. And it works very nicely, so you can have like complete two interactions in terms of interoperability bidirectionally, so you don't have each part of the code that's each other part.
It's interesting. So what I think would help a lot in this regard is if the Java compiler would kind of allow for more extensibility, so for the ability to plug in other compilers, to plug in, you know, have better faces, better separation of faces that you can. So is there some GCP around?
So kind of compiler extension of JSR is not related to the macros one, because this will be only for the Java language. Yeah. But what if there were to be some kind of compiler API that every language out there could be hooked into, so that just using the regular Java C, you would call the other guys at the right time. It would be awesome. I don't know if it's possible, considering that every language community has its own demons. And they say, this is how my language is going to work, and I don't care about the other ones. And there are some other people that are more open to some other ideas. I really would like to have that.
It can be very difficult in some cases. There's the compiler phases can be very different depending on the language.
Sure.
I think with like Scala, there's many phases of type completion is where things become complicated. Like, what would you know the type of all of the symbols in your code that you'd be ready to share?
But I mean, it got also more advanced to Java 8 anyway, right? So type inference is much more of a place. And so, I mean, if you have high-grade faces in the compiler in the first place, and in the normal Java project, you would just kind of skip or kind of shortcut certain faces, it would still kind of allow you to have a... But I'm not sure, is there JSR for Java polyglot?
No.
That would be cool to have.
At least not that I'm aware of. No, I haven't heard anybody talking about that.
I think... projects I worked on, I think we just ended up refactoring so that different Maven modules had, you know, we just moved things into the appropriate Maven modules. So I think in some circumstances it meant things were somewhat slightly ugly, but it seemed workable.
Yeah.
And you just, you know, there were just acyclic dependencies between the Maven modules, and each Maven module was one language, and that's that.
Yeah, it might even introduce some structure that you might find desirable afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you might be heading for the big compiler of everything, and all the projects would also probably have more dependencies, and the initial benefit of having some new kit developing much faster than Java might be also a bit in danger if you really head towards some kind of pidgin Java where you can write one method in one language and one method in the other.
I found the slow Scala compiler. Our obvious solution is microservices, because that's
the proper modularization.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. It takes also, you know, startup and compilation phases take their own time. Even if you have just a few, even if you have 10 Scala classes, it takes as 100 times as long as to compile a Dalton Java class.
Yes, no arguments. Scala compiler is good.
And you can use FSC or the GUI compile server.
So the time that you waste compiling is gained by how you can easily read the thing, understand it, and extend it. That's
kind of the balance, right?
Exactly.
It's interesting. I mean, I find there's a lot of trade-offs, right? Like, this Java tooling is way better than whatever... than Scala tooling, like just Eclipse or IntelliJ, and the Scala tooling, and it kind of gets getting better ever so slowly. But then, like, once you get proficient in Scala, it's sort of like a drug, right? Like, and then going back to Java just sort of sucks.
one of the things that I enjoy the most when switching to Scala was the SVT, and Maven has the continuous compilation.
Yes.
So you stop for a moment, you have to think, and the CPU is compiling for you. So the Scala compiler is very slow, but then in the end, on your last day, you only need to recompile that given file.
And if you're running compiler, it compiles over. Right?
And it's always like, okay, then it all moves into continuous iteration, and it takes forever because it's a fresh compilation, but still on your machine, you're still gaining some time already.
As far as I'm aware, the compilation speed is a priority in the Scala team at the moment. I'm not sure how much they can do with all the typing points and everything, but it is a priority.
And going back to the
language,
the Java team is talking, it's actually very interesting how the C long compiler is implemented, because they have actually both the Java compiler source code, and they have added essentially parser and AST transformations for C long, so they transform the C long.
they still go to the same AST that Java C uses to generate, and then they use the Java C existing bytecode generation to generate class files. This also gives them a very good solution for Java to see what interop because it's the same compiler, which across those kind of code, it's just a single compilation.
But how clean is the Java C compiler source?
I found it good enough. I found it good.
As a start.
It's a less sophisticated design than the Scala compiler, for example, but I think that's a good thing in this case. It's rather understandable and rather same.
Same author for both compiler.
I have to admit I haven't looked very much in terms of the Scala compiler, but I call the name of the page.
Something that Chris mentioned, what I would kind of just like to ask you all is, what's your experience with tooling, you know, IDEs, IntelliJ, Eclipse, NetBeans for doing polyglot programming, and also for things like debugging, for instance, bug information and things like that. So any feedback on these things? Did you have any good experience with something or any bad experience with something?
I can say one thing, apart from the usual, is that using Clojure with a light table is really a fantastic experience. Mm-hmm. This is the new kind of IDE, yeah. And it's still very early.
Yeah.
But when you use a bit and then you go back to normal IDE, you say, oh, we are back here.
So my IDE of choice for many, many years have been and for a while in Eclipse, I was John, I didn't know, I'm sorry. Then, for some reason, I found an idea, and most of my development right now, I think, good idea. So, the Java supporting idea, it's top notch. There's nothing else that I can say to praise it. The Ruby support is really good, but the amount of refactorings that are available, not so much compared to the Java ones. I love that there will be more. I know it's not an easy task. And then we have the CEO of JBrain sitting here. But it's very likely that will be better in the future. I don't know how fast, how slow, but I'm confident that it will be better. Any other tool that I use for writing Ruby? Not really. Because I don't know what is it with me, but I can write Ruby code very easily in a simple text editor. But if I want to do the same thing with Java, I get lost. It's like there is at least barrier in my mind that if I need to start writing probably static volume main and then what comes next? I don't know. It's really that stupid for me. But for Ruby, it's just natural. If I were to do the same thing with Scala, maybe. Clojure is very easy to me. There's no other syntax besides syntax highlighting and making sure that everything is aligned.
An IDE that's got equivalent key commands to power it, then your permanent balance on the volume. And the rainbow permanent helps a lot with that as well.
Yeah,
I think you agree about the light table point. It's one of the things that I like about Scala IDE. It's got the worksheet. It's mostly the same, so to do some
testing
very, very quickly, you get on there and you just copy paste into the actual code and you can get rid of that. I'm not sure if IntelliJ has something similar to that. I'm not very familiar with the Chessline stuff.
But by the way, I can do using IntelliJ with Clojure, Ruby, Scala, Java, this is.
Yeah, I've used IntelliJ with Clojure.
Just not having to change the IDE.
So we have sometimes some issue in the Maven setup thing with breaks with Scala and also with APT processing, yeah. Annotation processing stuff. So it kind of randomly doesn't find stuff across and
so on.
So
did someone say they use light table?
Yeah, I mean,
just play around, but not kind of serious development.
Yeah, it's been on my list. So what languages?
Right. Clojure and JavaScript. Maybe Python
as well.
But Clojure is native, so.
Yeah, Clojure is the one. Yeah. Focus on it. Huh. Initially, at least.
I would say the JavaScript was the main focus.
No, so it started out with Clojure as
the focus? Yeah.
But it's interesting because Chris Granger, the developer of Lighttable, worked on Visual Studio at Microsoft. So he did a 5-year or 8-year development at Microsoft.
So he stayed working much longer.
Yeah, so he was actually product manager there as well. So it's really interesting. But then he kind of completely cut his ties and rebooted and really liked the ideas that went into that and liked to see some of the ideas also pop up in other IDEs. Because it's kind of focused on the math level, and I really like that in general. Yeah, so anything on debugging multi language polyglot applications?
I hate debuggers. I think it's not a big change because, well, it's the same debugger for me. Essentially, the only difficulty that you have is when you are entering watches, you need to understand the language that is related to this part of the module which you are watching, you have to parse this correctly and so on. Other than that, and you have to deal smartly with anonymous classes which are generated by the compiler and controllers in some ways that you don't cover that.
I mean, I had an issue in the Scala, with debugging Scala, especially if you go functional style. It gets much harder to figure out what happens where and also the scope, you know, and then, you know, sometimes you just extract variables just to be able to see some intermediate results, or because I'm not sure, it's also limited on the fly execution, I think, for Scala expressions, right? Not sure. Something like that, there were some issues with that. And so it's for the kind of idiomatic Scala code, it was much harder to debug it, that was at least my experience.
Yeah, but my solution is to just write more tests.
I think that's what I thought too. Eventually, sometimes you have to break in the debugger. In the case of debugging Ruby code, it is almost as transparent as debugging Java code. You have to be aware, and that will come with experience, that when you want to step into a function, sometimes you will go into the meta object protocol dispatch mechanism. So you thought that, oh, this is just the next call, right? No, it's actually like 6-7 different calls before you actually get to where you want to go. So you have to be aware of that when you're at least working with Ruby.
Same with stack traces, right? If you get
But that comes from experience. You know that sometimes it's not the first thing that you see. There are a few more additional steps. So you just...
But you know that in IntelliJ you can put a watch step with in cascade, watch list that activate other watch list.
Dependent breakpoints.
Yeah, breakpoints, and sometimes it's the best idea because of this.
It would be nice if the debugger was more understanding of layers of calls, so to say, step into it. How do you really do this?
The thing that was resolved, not going through the whole dynamic, you know, how to resolve that. We have actually this, there's a setting for methods to skip over when stepping, so I'm not sure why it's not really by default in a smart way for Ruby, but recently it's just a.
How's actually debugging for Lambda closures in Java 8? Does it work? Or, you know, I'm not sure.
I haven't tried. This should work, right?
Someone told me that they kind of missed to compile the debug information for closures somehow.
I have never tried this.
When I did that some month ago, it was working, but inside the Lambda you have no names, so really...
So no debug information, so that's...
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, you can see the symbols, but no... But I think it's Java 8, it's not available here.
But you mentioned that the debugging style is quite good. You are using IntelliJ. It shouldn't be much of a difference. Debugging style in English is a bit grim, in my opinion, in Italy. Bit more difficult, but I would expect such behavior in English, but if IntelliJ is already providing this much information, maybe it's just a question of time.
But in Java 8, I think, I don't know what it is. It's much better using Scala in IntelliJ than Java 8 as debugging information.
So it's an interesting question if a mixed project of Java 8 and Java 6 Observer code would also be considered a polyglot application or not?
In the online form that we have, when you have seen all the information for people to figure out, I said, you are free to consider JDK8 as a different language. Why? Well, there, in a sense, the language itself hasn't changed so much from JDK6 to JDK7 to JDK8. It's just that some people may consider lambdas, a few tiny additions like the multi-catch approach that we have in JDK7, but I cannot use it because I'm stuck in JDK6 with my current customer. But when those small little things start to pile up and you are actually able to use everything from JDK8, it feels like a completely new language.
All of the project code stuff makes a big difference to code mobility. So like the string-based switches and all sorts of possible.
I would say that jumping into JDK 8 when it comes out, it will be almost as similar as jumping into JDK 5 when it came out. It was a different thing.
Yeah, we still have some models that have to convert, that have to write this Java 1.3. It's always a thing to do.
Can I ask if someone is using notebook? Is it a different language, do you think?
No, it's not a different language. It just makes you write less code.
So it kind of deals with the boilerplate and expressiveness kind of that you don't.
It is very hard to write your own transformations, even with Lombok PG. and you can only target, you can target Eclipse and Java C, it works with IntelliJ IDEA and NetBeans, so basically it works with pretty much anything that you would like to use. The disadvantage that I see of using Lombok in an enterprise is that people see these things as magical. It's almost the same thing, reason why they don't branch out to another JVM language. For example, Ruby would probably, in my case, would be a logical choice. Oh, dynamic. Oh, I don't know what thing is going. If you do with a Scala, oh, type safety. But you discover implicit. Oh, again, magical things happen. So no, let's stay away from those. How do you convince people to not be afraid of these magical things, I believe, is the hardest point.
And I think it's on two levels, right? So one is kind of the decision-maker and managerial part that you have to convince people to buy in. And the other thing is developers, right? So, I mean, we always have these kind of alpha geeks who like to play with new languages, who like to try out new stuff and be on the forefront. But you have a lot of people who just want to, you know, do their 9-to-5 day job and don't even be disturbed by all these crazy fancy stuff that goes along. And they would even program in Java 1.0 or 1.2 or something like that if they would be allowed to.
They also do.
That's mostly the motivation that led me to suggest the scaling up team. So how to change people's mindset into not a 9-to-5 job, maybe trying some magical stuff, which is actually not magical, but it requires some change in the mindset.
Exactly.
Is the language which is very good in adding, reloading, removing code during runtime? Is there anything to watch out for? It's problematic.
So JRebel does it.
JRebel does it for any JVM.
JVM is not so bad. There's also now a center called DCEVM.
Dynamic. I mean, more like having that kind of scripts that run inside the Java server or on the client, and that the user is able to replace and change. So it's not more.
So kind of extending the application with a dynamic language.
Yeah. Extending, changing, or removing things.
We did that with Groovy and OSGI. I can show you some code if you want to answer exactly this.
We actually did it as well in our IDEs. We had at some point the possibility to write Ruby my extensions, JRuby and PyCharm extensions in Python. But we scrapped all of this because the cost of speaking up with JRuby JavaTron is such a quite very significant, and no one really used the extension. There was like one of the people who never tried to write an extension. So, tough one. We would over the back of the job.
The problem with those languages, even though they run in the JVM, they actually bring their own environment. So it's a clean implementation of Ruby and Python inside the JVM, whereas Scala, Clojure, Ruby, Sagan, Kotlin, they are languages born within the JVM.
Yeah. That's beautiful.
And also another topic, another point is usually you don't want to have customers to have like a Turing complete programming language, but you will rather give them a DSL that's tailored to their domain.
Yeah.
And it contains their concept and doesn't kind of bring on any kind of other things. So you would either go with an embedded or external DSL that you just pause and execute. And that's often a better experience for a customer who wants to extend an application than a full-blown Turing complete, you know, Java, JVM language.
They also want the easy language that they know, like JavaScript. That's like what the first thing they come on. You know, they're not programmers. They're just people who can code if you like, of course. But so they want some language they understand and what you need to get off with.
Yeah, actually, that's the process we are taking into a few tracks, which is our mission track, where it has like programmable workflows. Essentially, we have built a DSL for programming these workflows, and we are giving the users essentially an IDE for designing. It's currently a desktop app that is going to be web-based eventually, and it just has enough of a language to write a workflow. It doesn't have anything else in it.
Yeah.
And fine, it works very well.
And it's all MPS based, right?
Okay, yes.
As you guys have heard, we're almost out of time, so let's close down with anything else that you guys would like to say, because the others will just turn by any second now. Is there anything else that you guys would like to discuss? We can continue the discussion tomorrow or on Wednesday, so let's put a new post-it if you want. I don't know. Any parting thoughts?
No?
Yeah, we have already some discussions for years about DSLs. We have just touched on this topic right at the very end, and we can just continue to discuss.
Yeah, so you should
a few of the things that we've covered and mentioned in the
I think you should do a lightning talk on
calling the phone.
We could do that.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much, guys.
Thanks.